So, again, where you would work would be the area where you are becoming aware of something that is disharmonious. We don't call it work, although it is work. We don't call it work when we are working for the sake of fun. When you become aware of something that you want to learn and you go out and you get the materials or read the books or talk to people, that doesn't feel like work. You've suddenly become interested in something. Some kind of awareness has bubbled up in you and you want to go do or learn something. So what we do in this kind of work, in path work, is we do specialize on the areas that aren't working, that are disharmonious.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And it seems to me that it's more important at this stage just to be kind of silently aware rather than trying to get in there and change things around.
How about if both are useful?
Beg your pardon?
What if both approaches can have value?
Well, I guess so, but I've never been able to make the right choice and what to change it. It seems like it's always a kind of a forced thing rather than organic, you know.
So number one, that may be your personality style, and we are allowed to have our own personality style. You're allowed to do things your way. However, part of learning is to gain a palette,
mm-hmm.
a variety of tools for different circumstances. So if we keep doing what we do best in the way that we can accomplish it fastest, that's not going to lead to a wide palette. It also doesn't make it wrong. Okay? So again, the answer to these questions would be, what makes you unhappy? What do you want to fix? So going back to the initial question about childhood criticism, for instance, you would ask the question, you would read this lecture and be attracted to it because you had a suspicion that you had a defensive attitude that became second nature and you now want to deal with it.
But that you still have that defensive behavior.
Yes.
Yes.
Because if you don't have it, it's not a problem.
Yes.
Okay.
Where I find that I have a little bit of trouble is connecting the disharmony to the cause of the disharmony.
Okay.
Like, I become aware of the disharmony. That's a beautiful word.
Mm-hmm.
But making the connection, is the disharmony caused by a defense? Is the disharmony caused by unconsciousness? Is the disharmony caused by... That's where I get stuck.
Okay. The greatest tool that I've ever found for answering that question is to keep a daily review.
I'm doing it. Since your last email, I'm doing
mm-hmm.
it. I am
so,
doing it.
So in the daily review process, mm-hmm. what happens is that you'll find some random stuff that doesn't make a story.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But you mm-hmm. will find things that are similar. And you'll begin to notice patterns.
Are those patterns also defensive?
Not necessarily. What we need to be careful here is we're looking for patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to look for what they mean and how they influence our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's very likely they're defenses because defenses are what get us in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so open attitudes, if they are non-defensive, and you can, by the way, have an open attitude that is actually a defense.
You can have an open attitude that's actually a defense.
Yes. In other words, your way of defending against criticism is to be open to all ideas at all times. So if somebody criticized you for being closed-minded, when actually you were just being focused. Okay, so let's imagine that someone that you love critiqued you for being closed-minded when your style was to focus on one thing at a time. That's just your style. But instead of that person being open to your doing things in a certain way, they criticized you. And if it happened at a certain place in your development or, you know, for whatever reason, what if you rebounded and you pulled away and you stopped focusing on things and you started just being generic all the time?
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's a defense.
Yeah.
That's not being done because that is your true nature.
Yeah.
That's not being done because it's exciting and wonderful and makes your heart sing.
Yeah.
That's being done so you won't get criticized. Now, one of the ways you can tell defense is it's got a forcing current to it.
A defense has a forcing current?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, if someone is dancing and they're having a great time, even if they're dancing very, very actively, there's going to be an energy around that dancing. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they're dancing to look good, there's going to be a different energy in that dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're dancing because they were told to dance, there's going to be another kind of energy in it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where we need to trust how we read the energy of what's going on in the situation. And that takes time and experience, and sometimes you're the only person who sees something in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And you're simply not going to get agreed with by the people that you're with and around that you care about.
Mm-hmm.
And part of being an adult is living with that. Sometimes we don't get agreed with. Sometimes the people we love don't see the things we see in the way we see them.
Well, of course.
But if you're not defended there and you're not wounded there, that is simply a reality.
Right.
It can even make you sad. But it's not tragic.
Right.
So when we look at problems, when we deal with problems in this work, we need to be very gentle and careful about what we call a problem, because you can't erase all the sadness in the world. And you can't necessarily be happy all the time. And anger as a feeling simply is. What we're looking for in this work are patterns of rage, patterns of defensiveness, patterns of disconnecting. Not because we like living alone or being alone, but because we're afraid of connection. And in that energy, there's a tightness. There's a tightness in being withdrawn, but there's also a tightness in submitting. Now, at one point in the lecture, the guide goes on about, well, it may be in the previous lecture, lecture 100, which is they're kind of a pair. The guide talks about how submission might seem gentle and loving, and being weak might seem soft, but it's not. There's a lot of energy in submission. Okay, submission is trying to get something. It's just a style of trying to get something. Withdrawal is also a style of trying to get something. So this is where there's no real way to divide reason, will, and emotion. There's no real line between the three.
Mm-hmm.
Because withdrawing is an act of will. And submission is an act of will. But it has a certain flavor and style to it.
And the third defense is aggression.
Right. Which, you know, obviously, that's the most direct use of will.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that there's will in all three pseudo-solutions.
Mm-hmm.
These are not calm, relaxed, normal ways of being.
What about the possibility of responding in a neutral way, like you might say to a person who's attacking you that I feel uncomfortable because of your negative output here, and I don't feel like I want to respond in kind.
Well, what you're stating has no energy in it, and therefore it's not a problem.
It's what?
It has,
it's not a problem?
Right.
So well, that's if, what I was trying to do, is to keep it from being a problem.
What I'm saying is you may have succeeded. So when you try to look at your life and say, what do I want to address? If it's not a problem, I would vote for not addressing it. In
well,
other
that,
words...
That yes? statement I just told you was something that's just come to mind with regard to how I would imagine that I would address a thing like that.
Well, all I'm saying is that that may be, and there's no place we can go with that because it's not a problem.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Right.
So it might be an answer then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So not everything in life is a problem.
Well, it would be a problem if you reacted negatively toward that negative output, right?
Right, but now you're in if country, and that's not what we're dealing with. We're dealing with your reality.
The reality, as a rule, is a negative response to a negative output.
But what I am saying is negativity, like a moment of sadness or a moment of anger, is not in and of itself a problem. Negative technically means no, or none, or even a minus. But it is inherently neutral.
But my response is usually I have a sense of disharmony when things are, argumentative and in verbal combat.
And if that's a pattern in your life and you want to address it, we would have to address it. But if that's simply an unfortunate occasion that comes around periodically, it has no juice in it. There's nothing to... You can't really work in a situation that is random and doesn't repeat and doesn't affect your life. So all I'm saying is that when we choose where to work, we need to give priority to disharmonious situations that repeat themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise we're frankly wasting a lot of time and effort on something that's random, spontaneous, and doesn't necessarily recur. So let me give you an example of this, using where we are right now. At the end of the lecture, when I redid the, I do a two-page version of the lectures so that you get a taste of it. I'm hoping that you will go read the lectures. I want you to read the lectures. But sometimes people just want two pages as a sample, so this is what I put on the website. And I changed it around because I realized that I have a different approach to this lecture than 4 or 5 years ago when I first put it together. And this time when I did it, I included some of the questions and answers that came at the end of the lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from the fact that the guide was delivering these lectures, and then afterwards there would be questions and answers. Now, sometimes those went off on different topics, and sometimes they were on the same topic. But this was an interesting series. The person who was questioning was asking questions. Sorry, that was a dumb thing to say. The person asking questions. Please forgive me. That was a momentary mind burp. The person asking questions was pushing the guide about whether there was a problem, if this. And the guide was saying what I'm trying to respond to now, and the guide was saying not necessarily. So for instance, the question was, you mean we should just listen to someone if they criticize? And the guide said, calmly listen and evaluate. But
say
you can't
again,
do that when you're
listen at what?
The question was, should we just listen to someone if they criticize?
Mm-hmm.
And the guide's answer was, calmly listen
mm-hmm.
and evaluate.
But as a child, you don't have those capabilities.
Right, but the guide's not talking to a child. So the guide's not saying that a child should do this. The guide is talking to
the adult. Okay.
Yeah, guide is answering an adult's question.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm hearing here and what I'm trying to point out is I feel in the person who's asking these questions, I feel protest. Mm-hmm. So let me read their question. You mean we should just listen to someone if he criticizes? Because of the next few questions that they ask, I hear a protest in this person. You mean I just have to listen?
Mm-hmm.
And the guide is saying, calmly listen and evaluate. And then the guide says, could there be some truth in the criticism?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a theme that goes throughout the lectures, that we get upset because, well, they're just criticizing me. Well, so what, frankly? Why don't you just listen and see if there's any truth in what they say?
Well, the protest is a defense, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Versus saying this person may not be doing it well, they may not be doing it with kindness. They may not even be doing it with a positive intent.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly enough, there might still be something here I could use. For instance, if you read film reviews or book reviews, the reviewer can be mean. They can say basically, I don't like the book, and tell you all kinds of reasons why I don't like the book. But they can still make comments that are useful to you.
Mm-hmm.
You can read between the lines and say, boy, this person does not like novels about the South. But between the lines, I'm reading that it's well written, and the characters are interesting, and I might actually like to read this book.
There might even be some truth about what we consider is a negative thing.
Yes. So when I read the book, I might even agree with the reviewer, but I may find the experience still worthwhile. So when someone criticizes, they can be dead wrong about most things. They may still have something to say that could be of value.
Mm-hmm.
The guide is not saying lay down and listen to this person for 10 hours. Guide is saying listen and evaluate.
Yeah.
See if there's a grain of truth in there. Okay? The next question, I presume from the same person, says, but what if we get annoyed at being unjustly criticized?
No, that's a good one, yeah.
But can you hear the protest in this?
Yeah.
Okay? What they're saying is, I don't like it. Okay? And the guide says, the very feeling of annoyance is the proof and expression of your defensiveness.
Right.
So the justification this person is putting forward, and I realize I'm putting something into this, so I'm just trying to use this as an example, only using the words and not really knowing the person. But the person's trying to put forward a case for not listening to criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And the guide's hearing that energy and saying you're in defense. The fact that you get annoyed means you're not listening and you're not evaluating.
You're not really accepting the moment either.
Yeah. So somebody mentioned about half an hour or 45 minutes ago that sometimes you just listen and relax and open and hear things. Okay? The person doesn't have to be right for you to do that. And when you're done, you say thank you and you walk away.
Yeah.
No harm done. But when you're annoyed, it tells you that there's a possibility that there's something going on in you. So if you go back to what the guide said in terms of what could it be in terms of criticism, you can go through this little, I think there's three or four items he just said. Are you annoyed because it's uncomfortable for you to accept the validity of their criticism? Is it that you don't wish to change, and this person is basically criticizing, and you're saying, if I listen to them, I'll have to change? Another reason to become annoyed at criticism is that this person could be exposing a flaw in your behavior. And you may feel that this could cost you love and acceptance from other people. That if other people heard this criticism and realized the truth of it, they might think badly of you. And this contributes to our resentment and our defensive attitude towards criticism. And what the guide says is, in truth, people do not deny you. They do not turn away from you because you are flawed. In general, people turn away from you because you won't accept reality. That's much more a reason to be rejected than the simple existence of having a flaw. So when we're annoyed at criticism, and these things are underneath it, okay, then our annoyance is a desire to resist change, it's a desire to resist exposure, and it's a desire to resist discomfort. It has nothing to do with the criticism.
And it's so easy to dismiss all those possibilities by saying it's unfair.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the guide goes on to say that defensiveness is not truth-producing. Being in a defensive state is not going to help you find the truth.
True, that's totally true.
And so one of the phrases in Pathwork is, what is the grain of truth?
Yeah.
So I'm going to paraphrase. I know I'm not going to get this right. But when someone speaks to you, there may be a mountain of untruth in what they say. But if you're affected by it, it's very likely that there's a grain of truth in there someplace. And your resentment is about the fact that it feels like you have to say yes to the whole thing or no to the whole thing, when the truth is that you don't. That you can listen to a lot of unfair criticism and basically say, I appreciate your sharing with me, and I do understand what you're saying. I do not agree with it, but I do understand what you're saying. Or if I don't, you ask questions so you can understand. And you can still say, I don't accept it. But you can help the situation enormously by finding the grain of truth in what they're saying and acknowledging it. It is an amazing thing. It's not manipulation. I don't believe it's manipulation. But what I have found by studying the Pathwork lectures is that when I'm in disagreeable situations with people, that if I can find a grain of truth on their side and name it and accept it, it's like building a bridge to them. I am demonstrating that I am not rejecting them out of hand. It demonstrates I'm listening.
It right, because that's the whole thing there, is that to be listening and to be really caring, and you can feel within yourself when you're being defensive or whether you're really honestly listening.
Right. What I find is that it changes the energy of the conversation the majority of the time. That when someone sees that you're listening and that you care and that you're willing to take some of their points, very often their need to be right comes down a little bit. And very often you can find more points of agreement. But it takes one person to put forward and say, okay, I get that point. But to do that, you can't be in defense. If I'm in defense, then that means that I'm closed against them.
Right.
And
you're
I'm
not
afraid
operating,
to.
And you're mm-hmm. not operating from your higher self.
Right.
This is sometimes where other modalities and people will speak of the ego, correct? So if you're not responding from your ego, then you're operating or responding from your higher self, which is a truer place, a more receptive, open, honest place, which that in itself shifts the energy and allows for a deeper engagement of truth, because
mm-hmm.
you sort of step aside.
Mm-hmm. I would like, however, to defend the ego. I believe
okay.
that in those situations, what they're referring to is an overbuilt or egocentric position.
Okay.
Pathwork takes a very generous attitude towards the ego. They claim that it's a valid part of us and we should respect it and build it and listen to it. But because of Freud and because of certain cultural things about ego, ego has come to have a certain negative connotation. So what I'm defending is that the ego by itself is neutral. But an egocentric position would be defensive.
Not allowing for there to be receptivity to that mountain of truth or untruth.
Right. So there's even a lecture called The Function of the Ego in the Patrick Lectures. And one of the things they talk about there is that, and I'm paraphrasing again, that you can think of the ego like a traffic cop in the circle. He's out there directing traffic. Okay? The ego says, time for the higher self to come out, or time for creativity, or where's the kid? We need the kid here. Time to be a kid. So the ego should be the input-output bureaucrat for information coming in and information going out. But what happens is the ego, the overbuilt, overblown ego, becomes involved and thinks their opinion matters instead of allowing the information to come and go freely. So unfortunately, in English, we don't invent new words when we're trying to describe something, so we use shorthand, and so the ego became a bad guy for a while. But the ego itself, like everything else, is neutral, and I think I referred to this before. When we examine our attitudes of things, it can be very, very useful to think in terms of what is neutral and how have I put emotional load on this situation. Okay? In other words, somebody's criticizing me. I'm feeling threatened. What's the reality here? Is anything going to happen if I say, sure, yeah, whatever? Is my life going to change? Is this review of my character going to be printed in the Los Angeles Times? Is it going to go on the Internet? Or is it just somebody's opinion?
It just goes on YouTube.
And even if it does go on there, who's going to listen?
Right.
And so what if they do? So this is what, it's a tool to examine your emotional reality. Say, are we inventing all kinds of consequences that aren't real? Because that will put you in a defensive state when you don't need to be there. And this is what the guide is talking about when he says that being defensive may have become second nature. So this is going to be a good segue, because I'd like to go here for a moment. Guide talks about that in defense, you generally speaking have one of two emotions. One of two feelings are predominant. One is fear, and the other is anger. That there's not a lot of grief in defense. There's certainly not a lot of joy in defense. But what there is plenty of is fear and anger. Now, once you have, and this, I believe this answers a little bit of your question of what happens when you are criticized as a child and you grow up with this. Well, one of the ways you can tell is that you're full of fear and anger. And your ability to experience the full spectrum of feeling is truncated. Because you're living in this narrow band. It's like having a rainbow and only living in orange.
But it's able to see or pinpoint where that fear and or that anger or both manifest in your life in order to see the pattern.
And you can do that because you are not your fear and your anger. You are bigger than that. And that's why I'm saying is eventually the rest of you gets tired of being in the shadows. The rest of you basically says, I've had it. You let me out of the closet or I'll do something. And that's a very positive thing. Okay? There's a time and a place where we're sick to death of only being a two-note song. And the positive of that is, what? Who's saying that? The rest of us. The rest of us, with our myriad of songs and notes and chords and colors, we're tired of not being seen. We're tired of not expressing ourselves. That there's a natural quality of wholeness that really starts to knock on the door and say, I want to come out. So the answer...
Go ahead. I'm sorry, please. No, please finish.
The answer to, but how do I know, is the very question itself. Anybody who's asking the question is hearing a knock on the door.
So I need you to tie in the what you just finished talking about, defense being fear and anger,
mm-hmm.
and tying that into the three kinds of defenses that you explained before, being withdrawal, submittal, and aggression.
Okay. All three of those pseudo-solutions are going to emphasize anger and fear if they're defensive.
Okay.
So, withdrawal. Why? How could withdrawal be full of fear and anger? Because every time you come near them, they spit at you. There's a withdrawal that says, I need some time alone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a withdrawal that gets angry. Can't you see that I'm taking a nap?
Mm-oh.
Okay? And there's a withdrawal that says, please don't, you know, I just can't think when you're around, please go away. There's a fear in that, instead of a simple, temporary withdrawal, or a simple preference for solitude. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
With emotion, where the anger comes in, is if you try... submission is a way of sticking your hand in and grabbing on and refusing to let go, but not wanting to fight about it.
Yeah.
Okay? And where you get the anger is when you try to make them let go. Okay? Try to make somebody who's submitting let go and you're in for a fight.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see some anger. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And where you're going to see the fear is they're terrified because if they let go, they feel they won't have anything. They've already given their self-esteem and integrity away by simply submitting.
Mm-hmm.
They got nothing left. And so you're going to feel their fear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where aggression, if aggression is a defensive mechanism, it's not positive aggression. I am a great respecter of positive aggression. I have a lot of it, and I have defended it all my life. Because a lot of people think that aggressive behavior is automatically negative.
Mm-hmm.
I think positive aggression is a necessary part of life. I think it builds bridges. I believe people use it to climb mountains. You use it to write books. You use it to walk to the store. It takes a lot of aggression to do the things in life. But when you're doing it with anger, or you're doing it out of fear, that's a defensive position.
Okay, thank you.
Okay? So one of the places I see this, let me punctuate this a little bit more. One of the ways I see this is I was going by, driving yesterday, and I saw the following sign in front of a church. And the sign said, fear of God is the gate to wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just, I can't even begin to say what I think of that phrase. And it was attributed to King David. And I don't care if he said it or not. There's a place where fear of God being the gate of wisdom is an example of submission rather than a proactive, positive aggression of reaching towards God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'd be looking to see how they translated that word fear, because it may have been awe or something. Well, there is a word that would work there, but it's not fear.
Yeah. But you can understand that even if the word was mistranslated, it took a certain kind of person to believe that this slogan should be put up.
Yes.
kind of person who thought that being afraid of God makes it work. Being afraid of God opens the door to wisdom. I do find it interesting. What if the word was respect for God is the gate to wisdom? Okay, but I noticed that because I was working on this teleconference and I thought, ooh, I need to bring that up for a defensive position. Okay, because one of the ways authorities control their citizens and parents control their children is by using fear.
That gets the obedience.
Yeah. So when the question comes up, why as a child was I treated like that? Because most parents, bless them, are not enlightened enough to avoid the use of an easy tool. And an easy tool to control a child is fear. Don't do that or you'll be punished. That's not a value judgment. That's not a philosophical invitation. That's don't do that or something unpleasant will happen.
Well, maybe that shows the evolution of the attitude about God from the Old Testament to now.
Very much so. And that's what the other reason I copied it down is I think that's exactly true. Assuming it's a valid phrase, which I very much appreciate bringing in the element that it's a bad translation. That's something we all forget sometimes.
Well, that's not the only place that fear of God's mentioned, though.
I know. So it's good to remember that there's a translation issue. But beyond that, even if this is the right phrase, this is from 6,000 years, 6,000 years ago. Okay? And it may be true that was an attitude on how to get the populace to put down their weapons, put down their aggressive behavior, and submit to the authority of a civilized society. All I'm saying is it's not an enlightened way of doing it. That's all.
Makes you question the infallibility of the Bible, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it would. And what our job is as adults is to question exactly the infallibility that we gave our parents and that we gave society. That part of being an adult is saying, I understand, and I don't have to accept that anymore. I understand, and I now think differently. This is a place of accepting our parents for all their flaws and all their limitations, and basically saying they did the best they could, and I have some attitude problems because of the way I was raised, and it's my job to address that. And this becomes a place where it can be an exciting spiritual journey. So let me segue for a moment. The question was asked, and I know I'm paraphrasing, so please forgive me. If you're criticized as a child and you grow up fearful, okay, isn't that terrible? Yes. But from a spiritual perspective, what the pathwork says is maybe that precise set of circumstances was set up for you so that you could learn something. Let me take submission as an example, because by the way, everybody submits and everybody withdraws and everybody acts out with aggression. It's just a matter of degree. When we submit, we give away our integrity. From a spiritual perspective, what if the life you led was set up so that you would give away your integrity until one day you said, that's enough. And you stood up as an adult, because that's normally when it happens, you stood up as an adult and you said, I'm now aware something's wrong. And then you seek information so that you can understand what happened, why it happened. And in that process, you would try to understand your parents in their limitations, in their personality structures. You would try to understand society, your larger extended family. You would also need to understand yourself and your own personality and the limitations of your personality. And that once you've got a pretty good feel for all this, and you said, okay, we're not going to do that anymore. From this day forward, I'm not going to knuckle under whenever I'm criticized. Now, it'll take a while because it's habit, because it's ingrained, because in effect it's a Pavlovian training. I hear criticism and my whole body goes into shock, but I can unlearn that. It'll take time. And you unlearn that. Let's say it takes 20 years. The joke version would be, what else have you got to do? From a spiritual perspective, that deprogramming, that unlearning, that ability to change massive programming from when you were a child and to become an adult who does not submit every time, submits on occasion when it is appropriate or when it can't be helped, but to become an adult who can do many, many different things and make many, many different choices is actually the point of human life, not becoming a doctor or a nurse, not raising a family, not making a lot of money, but to learn a spiritual lesson. The spiritual aspects of our lives can be slightly independent of the realities of our lives, if that makes sense.
Aren't you talking about awareness at the second stage of evolution there and the denial of awareness which because of its painfulness?
Could you ask me that question again slightly differently?
It seems like that whole thing has to do with shying away from being aware of what's going on. And maybe you deny that awareness. You keep going around in that circle there between reflex and awareness and don't get to understanding yet because of the awareness of the painful. Because it seems like becoming aware of where we should is kind of difficult.
Okay, what I am acknowledging here is that in the invention of humanity, whoever invented this craziness of being a human being, there is a reality to children only being able to take so much emotional pain before they come up with a defensive system. Comes with the territory. Kids do not expose themselves to infinite amounts of emotional pain. They come up with coping mechanisms. They come up with strategies. The coping mechanisms and strategies that we learn when we are children are not meant to last our entire lives. But once they become second nature, it's very hard to take off a piece of clothing that you don't know you're wearing. So what I'm trying to acknowledge is that you're not supposed to be a spiritual adult when you're 7 years old. You're actually supposed to be 7 years old. So you get wounded, you wind up with these coping strategies and mechanisms, and you wind up being an adult who's fearful. And what I am suggesting is there's a deeper meaning to life than paying your rent. And the deeper meaning to life is to turn this around. Not to make brownie points, not to impress anybody, not because there's a goal involved, but simply because being fearful, being withdrawn, being frightened, does not allow you to be most fully you. So that your spiritual task may be to turn this around And it doesn't have to be done overnight. There's no race. Nobody's got a scorecard on you spiritually that you know about. You can imagine that. And people can tell you that. But as much as I talk about the spirit world and how things work, I have no clue how this works. So why wouldn't your system be just as valid, or however you imagine the system in your mind, why wouldn't it be just as valid as what I imagine? So what I'm trying to stand up for here is that every single person has a unique spiritual task and significance, and they are the only ones who really understand or know it. My job as a counselor is to help people who are in pain to try to find out where to start working. But quite honestly, once you start working, it's personal preference how fast you work or how accelerated your progress is. I want to call that a style choice.
A what choice?
Style.
Uh-huh.
I'm saying that you're allowed to wear scarves or not wear scarves. You're allowed to wear makeup or not wear makeup. You're allowed to run to work or bicycle or drive your car. These are decisions we make as adults. They're really nobody else's business. And your spiritual journey, to some degree, is nobody else's business. Unless disharmonies result. So if your spiritual journey drives away your family, this is important for you to look at. It may also be an unfortunate truth that your spiritual journey may challenge your family's defensive system to the point where they have to reject you. That may be true, but I wouldn't assume it. I would want to look at it. I would, you know, if it was happening to me, I would want to explore and examine it so that I wasn't being defensive about their defense. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in other words, as an adult human being, you now have the opportunity to become a spiritual adult as well. And that part of that process is to look at your life and say, is this the life I want to lead? Is this the person I want to be? If not, then you need to do something. But what you do and how you do it and how fast you do it and what group of people you involve yourself with in order to accomplish this, the guide says there's no right or wrong answer. So when I teach pathwork, I'm perfectly happy for somebody to come to me for X amount of time, be it 1 week or 1 year or 1 decade, and then to one day say, got it, thank you. And now I want to go over here and do this. Because the goal is not for them to tie themselves to me or this work. The goal for them is to become an enlightened being, free to make choices and happy with themselves as they are. Or if they are unhappy, to go on a journey to explore that. So when we talk about the defense, the reason we talk about it is people who are in a defensive state, once they become aware that something's not right, what they're asking for is freedom from that. If they are not aware that they are in a defensive state, they're in effect not asking for any help, and there's nothing that I can do about it.
Well, if you're not needed as a helper any longer, at least you'd be a good friend.
And isn't that true of our friends as well?
Yeah.
If you have a friend with an issue, and the friend is not asking for your help, your decision is, do I wish to be friends with this person who behaves in this way? And if that's just a small part of them and you like the rest of them, you might well become friends with somebody who was defensive about about one particular item.
Mm-hmm.
You might choose to become friends with someone who is very defensive. This is a personal choice. But the reality is that your friendship with them may be one of the ways they become aware of their defensiveness. So friendship is a very healing and loving, love heals, let's just simplify it. Love heals. So being a loving family member or a loving friend can allow someone to come to awareness at their own pace. And that's where I was getting to, is once you become aware, once someone becomes aware, it's as if they've already won. They're already there. And some people will sprint, and some people will walk, and some people will saunter very, very slowly. But until you're aware, you can't do much about it. And once you're aware, it's the amount of pain that you feel, and the amount of creativity and freedom, and it becomes a lot of individual choices come into play. So what I'm trying to say there is that when someone asks the question, this hurts, what do I do about it? To some degree, they're already free. It's just a matter of time at that point. And I say that because I wish to be positive about people's process and not superimpose my value judgments on what they're doing. So are there any other questions on this? We may actually be complete on this lecture.
You know, that's been good.
Yeah, it was great.
Are you videotaping this?
No, this teleconference, I'm in California.
Oh.
We'll be leaving for Australia tomorrow night. And so the next one will be in Australia, and that won't be filmed either. And also I'll start filming when I come back in January.
Okay.
We'll see how that goes.
Sure like that. That last one in particular without the headphones and where you could hear the questions.
Yeah. I sent Harry a copy of the last two that I filmed, and there were technical glitches in one of them. So what he's saying is it's nice not to have the technical glitches. So. I would agree. Well, I'm working on it. It takes a bit of doing.
Well, it's good to see you on there anyway.
Thank you. So are there any other questions regarding the lecture, or?
I personally want to ask you a question when the tape goes off.
Okay, what I can do is this. The tape itself doesn't go off, mm-hmm. but I'm going to cut it. I will probably have cut it before we had all this talk. So I will probably clip off about Harry talking about the video. Okay?
Okay.
So why don't we presume, I truly presume that I will not use this part of the tape. And I'm happy to open up to questions of any type at this point.
Is there someone that wants to go before me? Because I'm always misspoken. So
oh, I doubt whether anybody's going to have the courage to interrupt you.
It's like I do. Please. I'm so sorry. I never mean to interrupt or take up time. I just find it, for me, I it's so easy for me to engage in this, and I look forward to it, so I guess that's why I'm always the most verbal one. But sometimes afterwards I feel as if I should apologize, and I never mean to. My intention is never to take someone else's time. I don't ever mean to do that.
So let me address that, because it's been mentioned before by people sometimes after the conference, and I think it's important. There are always a mixture of people's personalities, and some people are more forward at different times. It helps people to have questions asked. Okay, so you may not realize it, but you may be asking a question that other people either wish to ask or have not yet formulated.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the value of group work. So I value group work. I think that group work has the possibility of accelerating people's work more than individual work a lot of the time. Notice I'm qualifying that all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Because the questions asked, the real-life questions asked by other people, usually have some quality of humanity in them that we can use for ourselves.